It's time for No Copay Radio, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Government's Area Agency on Aging. Here are your hosts, Murphy Houston and Jayla Sanchez Warren from the Area Agency on Aging.
Welcome back. It is No Copay Radio. Happy Sunday, everybody. This is Murphy Houston. Now, normally I'm joined by Jayla Sanchez Warren, who runs the Area Agency on Aging with Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments, but she is off today. So good for her. She needs a little vacation time. But our good friend, Dr. John Douglas from Tri-County Health, formerly with the CDC, is here for his weekly catch-up on COVID-19 in the state and nationally. And Dr. John, how are you today?
Murph, I'm doing fine. Hanging in there, enjoying beautiful fall weather.
This is my favorite time of the year in Colorado is fall. It's so beautiful.
It's fantastic. I spent the weekend in the mountains, and I haven't seen prettier aspens in at least a year, maybe longer. They were beautiful.
Well, that's good. That's a good way to get away from the madness is get up to the mountains a little bit, especially this time of year. And unfortunately, though, I don't like what happens after this time of year. But the skiers love it. Let's put it that way. It's good for
them.
Yeah,
I hear there may be snow in a week or two up there.
So, nothing surprises me. So let's do a little catch-up here in Colorado on what's going on with COVID-19 and the Delta variant. Good, bad news, what's up?
You know, I'd say that the news is pretty monotonous right now. And what I mean by that, it's kind of the same as it was a week ago when we spoke last time. Cases are going up a little bit. Don't know if that's a start of a trend. Hospitalizations are holding steady. They're not dropping as much as I'd like to see. We haven't seen what we saw last year, I want to be clear. Last year, by this point in early October, we thought what might have been just a little bit of a post-Labor Day spike really started to crescendo. And we were well into our way of moving into a very bad fall and winter. We're not seeing that now. And I think that's because even though Delta is, you know, I think we've been living with Delta long enough to know it's unequivocally worse than the first strain that we encountered. I think the vaccines are holding us in very good stead. I think the question is going to be folks who are recommended to get a booster, getting their booster, the remaining 30-something percent who haven't gotten a vaccine, please, can we figure out a way to persuade you to get a vaccine? And then we're very eagerly awaiting what the FDA is going to say about vaccines in younger kids. So I think that's kind of the landscape at this point as I see it.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the whole thing about kids under 12 years old. My daughter teaches over at Willow Creek, and you probably know by now that yesterday they shut down the fifth grade at Willow Creek because of COVID. And she's a little frightened by that. And there's some other cases around, and I guess it's going to probably help with that vaccine to kind of prevent the shutdowns, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. And you know, the kids, and I always hear breaking news from you and your daughter, Murph. I hadn't heard it yet, although I suspect I will later today. You know, the kids in the schools have been required to wear masks, and we think that's a highly effective way to prevent transmission, but we know it's not perfect. I don't know whether there was a lapse in mask wearing or something else happened, but you're absolutely correct. To keep the schools, you know, back to where they used to be without these sort of interruptions, I think vaccines are going to be the major contribution. I certainly hope that all of the parents in our communities are listening to the news and watching it, and watching how carefully the FDA is going about the business of reviewing the data before they make a decision. And I say that because whenever they do make their decision, and I think they will decide to approve it or at least to authorize it, that'll be perhaps a little different than being, quote, fully licensed, because they may not jump to full licensure. I want all of our parents to have been watching it and to feel comfortable. Yep, they probably made a good decision. Yep. Just like hopefully I got the vaccine. I feel good about my kid getting a vaccine. There's some polling data that suggests, you know, understandably in some respects, parents may want to kind of take their time. But the sooner all of us, when we've got the vaccine available, can act, the better that we'll all be.
Well, I agree with it. I've had all three shots, including the booster now, and I've not had any issues whatsoever. And you feel more comfortable when you have it. You feel a little more protected, and I think it's important. And getting back to the school situation, again, my daughter, I'm quoting her a little bit, she said, part of the problem is with these younger kids that are wearing masks, there's other viruses going around, colds and even some kind of intestinal flu type thing, and it's tough for these kids to keep a mask on if their nose is running and then they're sneezing all the time.
Well, that's a good point, although honestly we're asking kids who've got colds with running noses or gastrointestinal illnesses to stay home. So if it's allergies, that's one thing, but if you've got a cold, because, you know, my cold could be your COVID, we're really asking people to stay home. I know that it's tough if it's a pretty minor cold to keep a kid home, and that becomes a sort of a gray area. But I do understand what your daughter's saying. Even if it's just allergies and I'm sneezing a lot, the mask is can sometimes be more challenging to wear. There's no question.
It's a challenge for teachers all the way around and parents as well. I did see something interesting. By the way, we have Dr. John Douglas from Tri-County Health with us on the news just the other night that a lot of restaurants, they're taking like off nights like a Wednesday or a Tuesday when they normally aren't busy and having it strictly for people that can prove they've had the vaccine shots, either through some kind of a test they've had or if they got their COVID card like I carry all the time. And they're finding business is booming on those nights because people feel safer coming out.
You know, that once again, Murph, you're scooping me. I hadn't heard that one either.
Hey, I'm on the cutting edge, buddy. I do my homework.
But I'm incredibly pleased to hear that. I mean, I'm pleased to, number one, hear the restaurants are moving down that pathway, and I'm super impressed to hear that it's paying off for them. And, you know, I'm one of the kind of people, I got to go find out which restaurants are doing that, because I'm one of the kind of people that would say, okay, I feel really safe doing that. That's I don't usually go out to eat on a Wednesday night, but let's make an exception if I can go to a safe place. So that's really fantastic news. And you know what? That's the kind of thing in this contentious time when, you know, the president, the governor is considering whether mandates for vaccines should be required, which I think can be very effective. But in this day and age, they're very or can be very contentious. To see that sort of volunteer effort being made by the private community and it being paid off, I think, is really a great story.
Well, I agree. But again, I was reading where President Biden is going to maybe be doing something he said when he ran for president that he was never going to do, but it's going to order vaccine requirements. I mean, how will that work for the, 100 million plus people that haven't had any vaccine shots? Will that be effective, you think?
You know, I don't know. I mean, this was announced about a month ago that, first of all, federal employees and contractors were going to have it. That was going to include the military. There was going to be a request for an emergency rule by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, who takes care of worker safety. It's my understanding that they're developing those rules now. I think it's at least originally it was supposed to apply for businesses with 100 plus employees. And we haven't yet seen when or what that's going to look like. One possibility is it will include a vaccine or get tested option. There are a number of different entities that have required vaccines that have allowed a testing option. Others have not, and it'll be interesting to see how the president goes on that. But I think maybe we talked last week, vaccine mandates are not some newly created entity in the U.S. We've been using them back since the beginning of the country for one infectious disease or another. And we're passing, by the way, 700,000 deaths. And I think we've all just got to be super aware of what an enormous price we've all paid due to this pandemic.
Absolutely. I agree. Another topic I want to mention, and apparently this is really picking up as far as popularity, are these rapid at-home COVID testing things. And I'm just curious, people are buying them left and right. It's hard to keep them on the shelves from what I've been reading. How accurate are they? I mean, are they effective to have some of that hanging around the house?
You know, what I've heard about a Merck is that they are, in fact, quite effective. Let's be clear, no test we have is perfect. And so at-home tests will have pitfalls just like other ones do. But this new generation of tests does appear to perform more effectively, meaning if you have infection, it will truly tell you that you have it. Or if you don't have infection, it will avoid incorrectly telling you that you do have it. So not perfect, because those are the two parameters we always consider for a diagnostic test. But they do look like they're going to perform quite well, and I think will be a major advantage. You know, testing has gotten so much easier than it was, you know, even 6 to 8 months ago. But still, you've got to make an appointment. You've got to leave your house. You've got to go and wait somewhere. The test has to be sent off. And I think these at-home tests could really be a major advantage for lots of people.
Well, I think so. And really, I feel more comfortable having a test at home and doing it myself as opposed to going out amongst other people getting tested. I think a lot of people might feel that way. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess one other caveat is that, you know, follow the instructions carefully because a test that's done incorrectly will produce less reliable results. That's always been the fear of doctors like me. If I give you the test and you take it home and you do it yourself, are you really going to, you know, follow the instructions carefully? I know you would, of course.
No. In fact, I was just going to say that's one of my weaknesses. I'm one of those guys that'll buy a toy for the kid and say, I don't need those directions. I can know what I'm doing. And it's all a mess when I'm done. So I don't know what I would do with an at-home COVID test.
In all seriousness, if you are using those tests, just be careful. They're designed to be fairly foolproof, but they're not designed to have you throw the instructions away. So you do need to follow them.
I will. I always respect the doctor, if you know what I mean. So one thing before I let you go here, Doc, everybody's starting to gear up because the snow's coming. That means the ski resorts are going to be busy and opening up. What do you see some of the restrictions that might be happening this time up at our very popular ski resorts here in Colorado? Will they be masked all the time, or do you have to be having a vaccine? You have to prove it, anything like that?
You know, I don't have definitive answers for you. I know they're all thinking really hard about that. I think they're, like every other part of society, they're going to be trying to get more and more back to normal. But, you know, their whole business model is to accept people and encourage people to come not only from all over the country, but all over the world. And they know they have a mingling problem, or at least a potential mingling problem. I mean, some of our first really bad outbreaks were around ski places back in March of 2020. I think they're likely to have some pretty stringent rules about proof of vaccination, and if not, masking. You know, I went skiing just a couple of days last year, and you pretty much couldn't go indoors to have a cup of hot chocolate. You had to sit outside, and that's fine if the sun's shining, and it's less good if it's snowing hard.
Yeah,
I know they'd like to try to return to some indoor facilities, but I think they're going to be quite careful in doing it. I will say, though, that when you're sitting on the chairlift next to your new best friend from Australia, you know, the outdoors remains a very safe place. And so I think their business model, except for that indoor setting, is in general based on what should be a very safe sort of set of circumstances.
Which is good news. And I would imagine that if you're calling a ski resort for maybe tickets or some kind of vacation plan, I don't care where you're coming from, they probably, like the restaurants do and a lot of places do, businesses do, they lay out their COVID regulations. Don't you imagine they tell them that?
I think they're going to lay it out pretty carefully, because the last thing you want is for people to show up and get angry and be, you know, unhappy. And frankly, a lot of them may require testing, and the testing could be done with the home test you and I just talked about, although some of that testing does take scheduling because some entities have different requirements. So I think it's almost like everything in COVID, whether you're a public health department or a private business, communicating clearly to your stakeholders is, I think, an important part of the game.
I agree. Good advice again from Dr. John Douglas from Tri-County Health, formerly with the CDC. John, we appreciate you coming on every week and updating the situations and giving us your very valuable opinions, even about mine not following directions. I do appreciate that. No doubt about it.
This is your homework. Yeah. Next week, I want you to follow directions.
Okay, I'll do it. And we'll talk to you next week.
All right, take care of yourself.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for hanging out there with us. And you guys, thanks for listening. This is No Copay Radio on Cozy 101.1, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Government's Area Agency on Aging, sponsored by Jayla Sanchez Warren. She's the boss over there. She's tough. And usually a co-host with me on No Copay Radio, but she is not with us this weekend. If you have any questions about things we talk about that involve Dr. Cog, you can call them 303-480-6700. Hang on. We'll be right back with another guest.
We now continue with No Copay Radio with your hosts, Murphy Houston and Jayla Sanchez Warren.
And welcome back. Thanks for hanging in there. I am Murphy Houston. This is No Copay Radio, 7:30 every Sunday morning on Cozy 101.1. You can check out all the interviews we have on our website, KOSI101.com, No Copay Radio, easy to do. Joining us now is Dr. Bryce McConnell, a behavioral neurologist in the Department of Neurology at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus and director of the Sleep Research Program at the University of Colorado Alzheimer's and Cognition Center. And Dr. McConnell, thanks for joining us on No Copay Radio today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, we talk a lot about Alzheimer's and dementia and how that affects people, and not necessarily total seniors, grandpas and grandmas and older parents, but a lot of people. And this is a real interesting topic we're going to talk about today, because I didn't really know there was a connection between sleep and Alzheimer's. So can you tell us why you're studying that kind of a connection?
Sure, yeah. This is something that got me very interested in, you know, Alzheimer's and sleep and what the brain is actually doing in sleep back when I was in medical training. And you know, as a medical student and a resident in training, we don't really get a lot of sleep. So you think about sleep a lot when you're not getting it. And I remember hearing a talk, and someone was saying, you know, there are these studies that are coming out that are saying people who aren't sleeping well may have a higher risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. And I remember thinking, that is so fascinating. What is actually happening there? How does that work? And in the bigger picture, what's sleep actually doing for our brain? So I remember thinking, well, you know, what do we know about sleep? And I sort of dove into some of the literature and started learning about it. And the more I learned, the more fascinated I got into understanding, you know, how does sleep protect our brains, and why is it so important that we sleep?
Wow, that is an interesting topic. I'll tell you, I've done morning shows on radio for a long, long time, and I always knew I was not getting enough sleep and been warned by neurologists. That's going to affect you down the long haul. Is that true? I mean, not getting enough sleep, has that kind of effect where maybe it does do something with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so it looks like there probably is a connection there. It's not clear exactly how it works still, but you know, looking at big population studies, it seems like insufficient sleep is one of the risk factors for developing Alzheimer's. I think, you know, it's important to keep in mind that sleep is just one of the risk factors, and there are a lot of other things that are also very important for brain health. But, you know, certainly I think sleep is sort of this thing that we all take for granted unless we're not getting it. And then, you know, when we're in this situation where we're thinking, well, gosh, you know, what is that actually doing to our brain? Over the long run, it probably is actually a pretty important thing. And it's not surprising that, you know, something so important for our brain could increase our risk of getting brain health problems like Alzheimer's disease.
So you're saying not getting enough sleep is a risk of developing Alzheimer's. How does that work? Not to get too technical, because I'm sure it's very technical. I just don't understand that. And I'm sure a lot of people don't.
Sure, yeah. Well, it certainly is a bit complicated to explain from a neurophysiology level, but just sort of big picture thinking, what we know about sleep is that there are some very important processes happening in sleep that are brain maintenance functions. And when we think about the brain, we can think about the brain as a pattern-building machine that builds these cellular representations of information that form memories in our brain. And every night when we go to sleep, we do these maintenance functions on the pattern building machine. And this is really a cool connection between sleep and memory and understanding how our memories form and how they get sort of consolidated and the learning process happens. Sleep is actually a really important part of learning. And we think that something goes wrong there in the same kind of pathways that are important for Alzheimer's and memory problems are also affected. You know, when we're not sleeping well and we're having a problem with the brain's maintenance program.
So there's a connection between, if I understand what you're saying, memory processing functions of sleep is connected to memory disorders like Alzheimer's?
Yeah, that's actually what we think is going on. So we think that, you know, the same kinds of systems that the brain is using in sleep to perform memory processing and to shape our memories is something that's affecting the Alzheimer's process, and that these memory issues that we're having when we're older and in disorders such as Alzheimer's disease are really disorders of the same system that's really a critical component of sleep.
Well, then what do you consider the right amount of sleep? I would assume it would be different for everybody, but is it?
Yeah, so it's true that all of us have some variability in terms of how long we need to sleep for our brains to be restored. And some of that's genetic. And we know that there are certain genes that get passed through the families where some families seem to be more efficient at the process, whereas other people have genes and they need a bit longer. So there's a range of sleep, and usually 6 to 8 hours is kind of a typical range for most people. We know that if we look at big studies across large populations, people who tend to sleep longer in the 10 to 12 hour range or shorter in the 4 to 6 hour range are probably in this abnormal range where something's not going quite right with those brain maintenance functions.
Boy, I'll bet if you do that for a long period of time, because I work with a guy here at the radio station that says, oh, I can get by in 4 hours sleep. And he's probably in his mid-40s and probably been doing that for a long time. So you're saying that's probably not healthy.
Yeah, you know, I think there's probably some component there where some people may be able to get away with it a little bit better. When we think about sleep and the ability for us to sleep or people to be able to get by with shorter sleep, it probably is one of those things where it's similar to people who are naturally athletic and, you know, they sort of have a metabolism that allows them to maybe not exercise as much and maybe not eat as healthy, but they still are in pretty darn good shape, whereas other people really have to work a lot harder at it.
Sure.
There's probably that same kind of variability with sleep, and some people may naturally be able to get by with shorter sleep. What's unclear is, you know, if you do that for a really long time, is that putting extra wear and tear on the system? Is there something that, you know, over many, many years, eventually it catches up with you? We're not really sure how that might work yet.
Well, so that's what you're researching. Part of your research is, does that affect you in the long haul? I would, you know, I'm no doctor, but I'm just guessing. It sounds like it might.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you're right. And we're trying to understand mechanistically, how could we tell if that's not going right? So, you know, could we actually monitor how your brain is sleeping and understand, is the brain maintenance program working the way it's supposed to?
Well,
that's actually, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and what kind of sleep are we talking about? Now, I'm kind of what I would consider a light sleeper. I mean, I hear every noise in the house in the middle of the night and I wake up and then I go back to sleep. But my wife, she could live through a tornado in the house and not have a problem with that. So what's the difference? Deep sleep, light sleep, does it make a difference?
Yeah. So when we think about sleep, we have a couple different types of sleep that we go through, and we go through these cycles every night, and we go through deep sleep, and we call it non-REM or non-rapid eye movement sleep. And then the other part is the rapid eye movement sleep. The deepest sleep is the non-REM sleep, and the sleep where we're dreaming, which is a lighter kind of sleep, is the REM sleep. And we think that both of them are important, and going through the cycles of the different kinds of sleep is also important. The sleep that we think is probably most important for the brain health and probably most related to Alzheimer's at this point is the deeper kind of sleep.
Well, that's probably what I'm not doing well. What if you're not sleeping well? What do you do to change that, or can you change that?
Yeah, so I think it's important to know that it's a medical condition you should definitely talk to your doctor about if you feel like you're not sleeping well. We always warn people to beware of over-the-counter sleeping aids. Taking some of those medications can possibly have side effects and might not be good for your brain in the long run. So definitely getting a good medical opinion and talking to your doctor about it if you're concerned about your sleep. We have sleep specialists, of course, if you find that you need additional help and you're having a really hard time and need to talk about, you know, what if I do need a medication? What kind of medication would be most likely to help? And we always warn people that, you know, when we use medications that are sedatives to fall asleep, those medications can make you, you know, lose consciousness, but they don't reproduce the normal sleep function. So they don't actually do the same kind of brain maintenance functions that natural sleep would do.
Well, I got to tell you, Doc, I have tried some of those over-the-counter sleeping aids, and I can't take them. I mean, you wake up the next morning, and you're like in a fog for hours until it finally works out of your system, and then you do it again the next night. I had to stop.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, you know, there's probably more than one thing going on there. We probably have that, you know, residual hangover of the medication that's still hanging out in your brain. But then there's probably also that part where you didn't do the normal brain maintenance functions. So it's sort of like, you know, you lost consciousness, you were out of it for a while, but your brain didn't do the restorative things. And then the next day, your brain's kind of struggling to keep going.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Bryce McConnell, who is studying the connections between sleep and Alzheimer's disease, which is a topic I'm sure most people don't even know exists. So is it possible now, doctor, to measure how well your brain is processing memories in sleep as an early warning sign of problems such as Alzheimer's?
Yeah, that's actually one of the interesting questions that we're working on in the Alzheimer's Center at CU. We think that there's something going on in sleep that we could measure. And what we know about sleep is that sleep is a maintenance routine for our memories, and we could actually see the brain processing memories. This is something that comes out of modern neuroscience, where we've been able to understand that when we're asleep, our brains go through a replay mode of memories. It's actually a very fascinating thing that you could observe the brain, and you could see that memories that were sort of active during the day go through a replay mode when you're asleep.
Wow.
And that's how our brain processes these things. That's actually this process called sleep-dependent memory consolidation that's really important for learning. And what we know is that we could measure that if we have the right kind of equipment and the right understanding of what we're looking for. So in this case, at the Alzheimer's Center, we're looking at brain waves. And these would be natural electrical activity that happens in your brain that you could measure with a recording technique called electroencephalography. That's EEG. So EEG is a way to measure brain waves, and you just need a little sensor that can be put into a headband these days to measure that electrical activity. And if you could read someone's brain waves, then you could see how efficient is memory replay mode in this person while they're asleep.
Wow.
And we think that that actually might be an early warning sign that something's going on with the memory circuits.
Well, and does that kind of how dreaming works in you? Can you dream about the day you just had, those memories you just talked about from your day or maybe a couple of days ago?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when your brain goes through replay mode in the deep part of sleep, you don't actually have a dream about it. So these are fragments of memories that are happening in a state of the brain where if you were to wake up right then, you wouldn't really be able to recall what kind of memories were being replayed.
Wow.
As you're going through the night and you get into that REM, the rapid eye movement part of sleep, that's when the dreaming kicks in. And that's actually thought to be another way that information and memories get incorporated into our brains. The REM would be sort of another mode of kind of simulation of what happens when you're awake and an opportunity to integrate information into your brain and really incorporate all that new knowledge.
God, that's a lot of fascinating research. How about age? Does age kind of affect all of this?
Yeah, so we were looking at age very recently and published a manuscript in the journal Sleep about the effects of age. And we were looking at these memory circuits across the human lifespan, so all the way from childhood up into older age. And what we saw is that the memory processing parts of the brain that are doing memory replay mode, those seem to change through our development and our midlife and our later life. And at this point, we're not really sure what all of it means or why age is affecting the memory circuits the way that it is. But we think that it has something to do with the kinds of memory circuits that are going on inside of our brain and that there's more than one kind of memory circuit.
Wow.
So we could see that when you're young, you have a certain kind of memory circuit that's really good at picking up new information. And then this other kind of memory circuit gets activated that's sort of a incorporator of knowledge that builds wisdom and concepts and gives you a greater structure of how the world works.
Wow.
As we get older, it seems like that kind of wisdom-building circuit becomes more and more prevalent, and the new information circuit might not be working as well. This is in the realm of being a little bit speculative. We're not exactly sure that this is how it works, but it seems like this might actually be the case based on what modern neuroscience is teaching us.
Good stuff there, Dr. Bryce McConnell. Keep up the work. A little complicated, but somehow it all seems to tie together the way we're structured,
well,
I guess. But
thanks. Yeah.
Thank you for coming on No Copay Radio. Keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah,
great to chat.
Yeah, it was great to check. I learned a lot on that. Keep it up. Hey, we're brought to you by Dr. Cog here at No Copay Radio, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thanks for listening here on Cozy 101.1, and we'll talk to you next weekend.
This has been No Copay Radio, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging, 303-480-6700. Join us every Sunday at 7:30 here on Cozy 101.1.